Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with USU Professor Paul Rogers. He authored a chapter in the new book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. We're going to talk about wildfire, as well as such issues as growth and housing, wildlife habitat, Native American co-stewardship, and myths of the Old West and the New West. Paul Rogers holds bachelor's and master's degrees in geography from Utah State University and University of Wisconsin in Madison, respectively. His ecology doctorate is from USU. He's an adjunct professor in the Department of Environment and Society, a USU Ecology Center associate, and director of the Western Aspen Alliance. So, Paul Rogers, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Tom. It's really nice to be here in person.
We'll have you pull your microphone around as you're looking to me here. That'll make it more comfortable for you. Yeah, in that direction, yeah. Should have done that before we went on the air. Great to have you. We talked a couple times before. I think we talked about aspens, right, before?
And
We talked about wildfire, I think, as well with a group. So we'll get to talking about wildfire. But this book, is of which you're a part, kind of outlines a whole host of broad issues.
Yeah, Tom, it's really exciting for me to be involved in this book. First of all, it's a new kind of writing for me. It's for a general audience. It involves a narrative. It involves kind of dropping a lot of the technical terms that we're used to using and really communicating with a broad audience about important issues and issues of limits in the American West.
By the way, I can't resist going to your broad bio, your big bio. So you have been a visiting fellow at University of Queensland, Australia, Fulbright specialist scholarship at Mendel University in Czech Republic. You've studied in Europe and Africa, right? So some elements of these issues are the same, right? But some would be different in the American West.
Yeah, the connecting thread for me and has really been centered throughout my career in the American West with forays overseas has been human impacts on vegetation and trying to realize what the causes of those are, but also working with diverse parties to try to wrestle down some solutions or ways forward. And that's really where my passion has been throughout my career. I started out doing wilderness impacts in the High Uintas, some over near your territory, and then moved on to disturbance ecology and did quite a bit of that in the mid part of my career. And then I've ended up, as folks have heard about before, in aspen ecology. And all of those things kind of come together because aspen ecology is a very interdisciplinary field involving wildfire and wildlife and human issues and land development and so on. So I feel like in some sense this chapter and involvement in this book has been a culmination of several threads that I've been studying throughout my career.
Let's start with some broad themes. So growth and housing. I talked a bit about this with Robert Frodeman on an overview of this book. What's your view? I know we'll get into talking about Island Park a little bit later, but all over the West.
Yeah.
This interface is very important.
Yeah, there's several chapters that deal with this idea, and we feel that in all of our communities right here in Logan, Utah. But the chapters in the book with Sedona, Arizona, and Telluride, Colorado, and Jackson, Wyoming, and Bozeman, Montana, and so on, they have some similar themes, but some diversity in those themes too, how they play out in those different environments. But and this comes to the central theme of the entire book, which is the idea of limits. But in those communities, they're really reaching capacity now. The issue is in front of us now. There's no more room to grow. And so trying to understand that and facilitate places for people to actually live and work is very tricky. And many of those sort of iconic communities are extremely expensive to live in. One example that comes to mind that I was reading through last week in Telluride, Colorado, by the authors Joan May and wrote on that chapter, is that they're out of room. It's a narrow valley. It's very expensive to live there, but there's no place for the people that make the town run to actually live and work. It's too expensive, or there's simply no housing. There's waiting lists. But in the midst of all this, and Joan May has spent some time as a county council person, I think, and knows the local politics, near the end of the chapter, she talks about a brand new hotel being built that's going to need 300 employees. There is nowhere for them to live and work. And so that puts things right at the precipice of where these situations are coming up. Similar story in Jackson, Wyoming. Luther Probst writes about that. Extremely, you know, the average price of a home in Jackson is something like $5 million. I mean, that's not even in the stratosphere for most of our budgets, but you can imagine most of those people don't even live there full time. So these issues are right in front of us.
And you do, as you said, the issues of workers coming in. Sometimes have to come from the town over, or three towns over, right?
Yeah, the case of Jackson, Wyoming, is a 35-mile commute from another state over a treacherous mountain pass, or a 65-mile commute within the state through a winding canyon road. And this is four seasons, and the winter season's quite a popular season. So icy roads, all those conditions. But, you know, driving an hour or two to get to a place to work and then driving home at the end of the day. And we go to these places we love, these iconic scenery, and we actually see traffic jams. Like, for example, going over Teton Pass. We didn't think that was possible, 20, 30 years ago. But this is the reality now. And so we're really bumping up against the limits to growth there.
Another limit is water. Some of these areas you're talking about, water isn't really the limiting factor, but other cities are.
Right? Certainly. Yeah. And that is a theme that's written about again in several chapters, looking at the Colorado River, looking at the Snake River, looking at the Great Salt Lake with Bonnie Baxter here from Utah. And it's certainly an issue. We're overusing our water. We all know that. But the interesting thing is, and we feel like this is a first step. This book is a first step in realizing these limits. It's almost like somebody realizing they have a personal health problem and they need to come to grips with that and then develop some strategy. So we're all very clear on this is not the be-all, end-all, this book, but it's a launching pad for sort of where do we go next? Where should research go? Where should politics go? Policy making and so on. But with water, that's obviously right at the center of living in the West, an arid region, and we're running out. We're overusing it. And so that's a big issue that's dealt with in four or five chapters as well in this book.
I want to skip to talking about myths, because I think it does, myths hits on limits, right? Or denial that we have limits.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And Robert Frodeman talked about this about a month or so ago on this program, but diving a little deeper there, we've spent a lot of time and a lot of ink talking about Old West and New West. And the Old West is characterized by grabbing resources and the sort of lone soldier approach. You know, that's certainly a myth. All of the big things I would say that we've done in this country, the heroic things, as well as in this region, have been when we've come together. Maybe we don't acknowledge it. Maybe it's not Hollywood ready. But that's when we've really made some traction, and our proudest moments is when we've come together. If you think about the Great Depression or the World Wars or some of the things where we've really established ourselves of, yeah, we can do this. It's the coming together. So that's the Old West. And the New West, at one point, I think that phrase had a lot of promise, but it's come to be just a different form of resource grabbing in terms of recreation and development and so on. But it's a little bit of the me generation multiplied in terms of I got to have my fun. I want more recreation. I want to go out and grab that. But I also want to plant a house there. Maybe it's a second home. What I think this book really gets at is the real West or the future West, where we need to be, and realizing that limits is at the center part of that, but also solutions. That's the cool thing about this book is all these chapters that are very place-based come out at the end with, here's kind of where we need to be going, making a suggestion for a course forward that's positive, that brings folks together, even folks of diverse and divisive opinions.
We talked with Robert Frodeman about the power of myth, right, and the power of images, movies, television advertising, right? And, the movies, it's the rugged cowboy, the individualist, John Wayne, that kind of thing. And the New West has some myths, advertising images as well.
Most definitely. Those myths are not only attractive, I would say they're even intoxicating. We want to live that way. It's even infused in some of our politics. And we'll get to this later when we talk about Island Park, because it's a little different than those other iconic communities I mentioned. but it's the striving for, I can do this alone. This is, we've grown up with these myths, and the hero comes into town and fixes everything, that kind of thing. But it can go too far when it becomes sort of something that we're groping for that's not real, but actually can get us into trouble as we press up against those limits.
And we'll get talking about solutions as we go along later in the program. Let's talk about wildlife habitat. What are some issues that interest you there?
Yeah, there's a few chapters on that, and this is not exactly my area of work, although I do work with this in the Aspen ecology realm a fair amount. But this chapter by Emily Reed and Matt Kaufman about these really long distance, in fact, the longest distance migration routes of large ungulates. So we're talking about pronghorn antelope and mule deer and so on in central west Wyoming. But where this comes to a rub, a literal pinch point, is when you run into oil and gas development and now second home and suburban sprawl development in these oil and gas towns. And so the animals need to go through these narrow pathways of habitat to get to their end destination, essentially from the Red Desert in the south up into the mountains surrounding the Jackson Hole area, the Gros Ventre Range, the Teton Range, and even over into Wyoming. There's a fun story about one of these deer that's documented to have roamed, I think it's 250 or 60 miles, but right into my realm, ends up in an aspen grove, the same place year after year. So really seeking out that habitat. This is a really valuable asset, a resource of the American West. However, in these pinch points, we need to play together a little bit better. We have federal agencies, we have private development, and we have oil and gas exploitation going on there. And they talk about how they're working through that. And they've really done an excellent job of highlighting the value of this habitat in these narrow corridors around some of those towns like Pinedale, Wyoming. And so that's a really interesting chapter to look at. And they really have come out in a pretty good place. The folks of those that town have really rallied around finding exactly where that those narrow corridors are and saying, yeah, we collectively agree to not develop these, to preserve this habitat in some way, because this is such a valuable part of, back to our last conversation, the mythology, the wide-ranging animal and free range faced with our modern reality of, oh, wow, we're going a little too far here. Maybe we can't have this many fences, this many drill pads, this many homes going up.
It all has to be purposeful, right? I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? Priorities, right? But, for example, this project, protecting habitat corridors for migration, entropy is not going to do it, right?
That's right. And that's kind of where we've been. It's sort of the crossroads of the mythology, but also the development, the economy, our particular economy. We're used to sort of this free reign sort of approach. And when that meets reality, we got to quickly come to solutions. Part of what this book tries to do is have us do a little forecasting and a little bit of thinking. What happens when some of these issues come to your town or to your county or to your national park? Well, there's some roadmaps out there for folks who have been through or are going through those issues right here and now.
Let's talk about Native American co-stewardship. What strikes you in that theme?
Yeah, I think probably one of my favorite chapters in the book is an interview with Regina Lopez White Skunk, and she's from the Southern Ute tribe. Interestingly, one of her parents is from the Northern Ute tribe, so she which is here in Utah, but the Southern Ute tribe based in Southern Colorado. And she's interviewed by Evelyn Brister, one of the editors here. And I thought, well, this is going to be a dry interview chapter. Nothing against you and your profession, Tom. But it'll be sort of just here's what goes on. But what Regina does well is talk about this topic of co-stewardship. And I was at a conference and actually met her this summer in Colorado. And the idea is to give more voice to Native peoples in the areas where they historically lived for thousands of years, in terms of our management decisions. I often say in the Aspen realm, let's go to the playbook that seems to have delved well with the ecological function of a community. for a long time, that's probably a good place to start for looking for solutions. But what Regina does that I think is really excellent is that somehow she invites us into her heart and into the heart of her culture in saying that and she's talking about the chronological development and the pushes and pulls that have gone on with the Bears Ears National Monument in southeast Utah. But she tells us, and she really invites us into understanding Native American culture and how critical the land is and the landscape and the plants and animals that live there in a way that's it's not only endearing, but it's effective. And so why wouldn't we engage in co-stewardship when we have this knowledge base that I think pairs well with the scientific approach? But there's going to be some give and take there. But that's really enjoyable to hear her walk through that, her pushes and pulls with that, involved with Utah politicians and then going to the federal level and eventually to the president of the United States and working through, you know, how are we going to solve this issue of these sacred lands and create a national monument that will work for many people, but to give a true voice in that. And I have to emphasize that term, sacred lands. It takes on a different meaning when you talk to Native American folks because it's in the bloodstream, you might say. And it's really wonderful, and I really appreciate her contribution to this book.
Well, it'll be interesting coming up to see what the Trump administration does. They shrank it before. They probably shrink it again. It's back and forth. Antiquities Act. I don't know if that'll get litigated in Congress.
Yeah, I'd have to say, Tom, I'm not excited about this. The ping pong back and forth. I teach this in my Intro to Environmental Science course. We talk about this a little bit. It's in our textbook. Bears Ears National Monument's in our textbook. But the back and forth, I think we need consistency with our landscape management. But this new trend of co-stewardship, in my opinion, should be placed in the forefront because I think it's the right thing to do. And also, I think, not just for the people, but for the landscape. And so where that'll end up, it's anybody's guess, but we're all kind of bracing and seeing what's going to come up next with a new administration walking in the door.
By the way, when you teach your classes, what are the kind of the top policy intersections that you highlight?
Yeah, we talk about one that's been you might say a watershed moment, but is the Citizens United decision that came out of the Supreme Court. Oh, it's over 10 years ago now, I believe. But that idea that a corporation is a person, for a lot of people, that's a little confusing. What does that mean? But the idea that the corporation would have more rights than or as many rights, the same rights as people, one of the things that we teach and we get into quite deep with our students is talking about, well, what if landscapes or rivers had those rights? And they do in some places. In New Zealand and Ecuador, there's places where a river had the rights of a human. And to the listeners, that sounds really funny. But if you think it through a little bit further, you get to this point where why wouldn't we treat these things with the respect that we have, you know, ourselves? You know, the right to live on, the right to not be abused. You know, the really basic moral principles that are taught in many spiritual realms, but also in many political and legal realms. Mm. Why not?
Yeah.
And so that's one that comes up and is quite on the plate of Native American folks.
Yeah. That's interesting, using Citizens United as a bridge in this thought experiment, right? If corporations can have rights, then maybe rivers can.
Right, and there's places that have done that. Mm-hmm. But again, yeah, we're probably a little bit way off for that in the United States. However, that ethos, I think, is right there in front of us. And this book doesn't go into that too much, but I'll hopefully be at a conference this summer in Finland where we'll be talking about this very idea.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get into talking about Paul Rogers' chapter in this book on wildfire. And we've been talking about the book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. We had a previous conversation on this program about the kind of the overall And Paul Rogers has a chapter in this book. Paul Rogers is adjunct professor in the Department of Environment and Society, USU Ecology Center associate and director of the Western Aspen Alliance. We'll have more with him following this break. Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the day is USU professor Paul Rogers. He authored a chapter in the new book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. We're going to be talking about that. It's on wildfire. He is adjunct professor in the Department of Environment and Society, USU Ecology Center associate and director of the Western Aspen Alliance. I think that's where a lot of people see you in the media, right? You, when something happens to Pando or something else, Aspen, they go to you.
Right. Yeah, I have a fun little article called Pando to Pangea, which are expanding that conversation starting here in Utah with this famous Aspen clone called Pando. And then we work our way up to the global scale where Aspen's actually wrapping around the northern hemisphere. It's kind of a fun topic to talk about.
Yeah, great. Maybe we'll a future program will talk about that in greater length. One more parenthetical from your bio, Paul Rogers. You appeared in an IMAX film, 2020, right? Into America's Wild. Tell me what the film's about and then what the experience was.
Yeah, that was a very unique experience, and that was also at Pando, this iconic Aspen clone that's 106 acres in size. But that's an interesting experience. I'll tell folks, you know, give up the secret here. Filmed for 16 hours or 16 hours on site for what ends up being about a minute and 20 seconds of a 40-minute film, but I was very lucky to not get cut from that. Oh, I'd say there's 15 or 20 segments in that film dancing around the country. But looking at a very optimistic approach to visiting the wild and preserving wild places and seeing something like that in 3D at an IMAX theater is really mind-blowing. And that's a cool one because it's also played quite a bit around the world as well as at all these IMAX theaters across the U.S.
Did you go and see the film, consume it?
I did, and we did an actual presentation
on
Aspen Ecology prior to the one in Salt Lake City here a couple of years ago.
Yeah. What's the process like in filming this? It's a different camera, right? It's special cameras.
That's right. They have to have multiple lenses to get that 3D effect. And what I was telling Tom before we went on the air is the drone. Most of you have seen a drone, is this kind of small vehicle that hovers around with a small camera on it. Well, this was pretty big with a big heavy camera on it and big blades and all, and it made a lot of noise, but they mute out the noise, of course, and they had some beautiful shots. Actually, I was working with the Ogden High School International Baccalaureate program there, and they had some really nice shots of us aerially walking through the forest, but they eventually got cut from the final edit on that one.
Yeah, that's the downside. You never know, right? But you did make it to the film. That's good. So Paul Rogers' chapter in this book, again, we've been talking about this, A Watershed Moment. The chapter's called it Home with Forest Fires in the West. Let's have you read a couple of paragraphs here.
Yeah, I'll kick this off by saying that, in terms of mythologies, we have mythologies around fire as well. And the way it's presented to us, I feel like I've been battling these themes for much of my career, is this sensationalism. It's naturally sensational, which you'll hear in a minute. But it's also very, very negative. And the idea of at home with, that title was supposed to be provocative, and that this is the place where we live and this is a place that's going to burn. So with that as a precursor, let me just read sort of the opening paragraphs of this chapter. Fire screams for our attention. A forest ablaze is nature's sensational headline. The images draw a visceral reaction. Do something. The response for the past century has been to suppress wildfires. National policy was to send teams of firefighters to douse ignitions before 10 a.m. the next day. Very optimistic look there. In hindsight, and what we think now, is suppression itself was a mistake, bringing an unprecedented menace in the form of accumulated fuels into today's forests. Yet we go on battling these flames with boundless budgets and military bravado. A vicious cycle churns, and we seem unable to stop the crusade that exacerbates the problem. We would be better to served by pressing the pause button on our reactions to fire. Let's apply what we know and have learned with fire rather than combating it. Fire will come. The future portends mounting combustion. Bad things happen to everyone. It's how we react that determines our character. How should we respond to future fires? So that's just sort of a teaser of how the book chapter starts out. But what I'm trying to get across there is we've changed our modes. We've over the past 100 or so years, we had a very command and control approach to fire. We know it better. We are humans outside of nature, and we're going to take over. We're going to engineer this thing. We're going to command it. We have an agricultural approach to forestry. And that's our crop that's burning, and we're going to take control of that and take it over. There's a lot of things we leave out of that story. And number one is climate. And when I say climate, people think of the future, but it's very rarely mentioned that the 20th century was the wettest century in the last millennia or two, a very wet century. So much more so than fire suppression, a wet century helped us out. But that's now the ethos that we've sort of grown up with as a country and as a region in combating wildfires, that, hey, we're pretty good at this. Matter of fact, we can build homes out into this and nothing will change and it'll be great. Fires are here and there. They're kind of wild. We see them on TV. Fire is the enemy is another big part of this. And what we're trying to convey, or what I'm trying to convey in this book chapter, is understanding this, understanding it in a certain place, and understanding how to live with it. And in a sense, it's our companion, and that may sound funny to a lot of folks because it's presented in such a sensational, negative, antagonistic way in our media. Trying to turn that narrative around a little bit, and if we're going to live here, whether it's a first home or second home, we need to understand that just like hurricanes and floods, it's part of where we live.
So you say the images are important here, right? Tragedy, inferno, these big fires really capture us on television. Something like paradise, I mean, that is a tragedy, right? We'd all say that, right?
It's certainly Paradise, California, and I have to say this: it's somebody's doing something to us. This fire is the enemy, and it's doing something to us. And why doesn't somebody do something about it? Instead of having the forethought to think about where are we living and how could this potentially happen, of course that's a tragedy when people die or homes are destroyed. There's no doubt. I'm not debating that so much. But those places, Paradise, California, was a completely forested town. There was a forest throughout the town. And then further, we don't hear this on the news very much, there's no doubt that the vegetation that grows in California makes it the most fire-prone state. Mile for mile in the whole union. It's just going to burn because there's very flammable vegetation there. So, again, I want to be crystal clear. I'm not discounting the tragedy of that. But how do we avoid tragedy? How do we see what's coming? And it's part of sharing our science with how we live as communities.
I want to go back and do a little bit more of the history before we get to Island Park and present and future. So you said agricultural approach to fire suppression. In fact, the Forest Service is still into the Department of Agriculture. That's a whole different thing, right? I think there was corruption in the Department of Interior, so they put it in ag. But this is our crop, and I guess our crop was timber, right? That's what drove this originally?
Very much so, and you need to protect the crop. And going back to the genesis of that history, the founder of the Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot, learned German forestry. German forestry was very much a crop, and we imported that to the United States. But the interesting thing is we imported that across a boundary from temperate zones, Central Europe or Eastern United States, into a Western dry area. And at that point, we should maybe be rethinking things a little bit. But so that's a little bit, without going into great depth, about the agricultural model.
So fire suppression, this has been a whole big debate, right? We did too much. We haven't done enough. Fuel buildup. We need to be prescribed burns. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that is a tricky subject, and I need to emphasize for folks. And we have a little sort of simplification of vegetation zones and how they burn at different periodicities or different timescales, from every 5 years to 450 or beyond. years, and so they burn differently. But we've also pressed this idea that fire suppression is the big enemy. I feel like in a lot of our culture these days, we're looking for somebody or something to blame, but fire suppression is now the bad guy. And we put forth the idea here. I put forth the idea based on other folks' research that fire suppression did not have that much of an impact. People often talk about 100 years of fire suppression our forests have built up. Well, that may be true, particularly in lower elevation forests, for example, where ponderosa pine might grow. And even there, that's debatable in some situations. But as you go up in elevation and those fire rotations or fire regimes become longer and longer, 50 years or even 100 years, let's just assume for hypothetically that we are 100% effective, would have little effect on a cycle that's that long. And so fire suppression is only a part of the story. But as goes our climate, dry, wet, let's just think simply, so goes the fire cycles. And those will come and go. And we don't even need to mention modern climate warming yet. We don't even need to get into that to talk about our more recent shift from a wet period to a droughtier period.
Now, at some point, we collectively decided we can go and build out there, right?
Yeah.
Roads were originally put in for logging, I guess, but we can go and build a second home or whatever.
Yeah, I have to say right off, everybody loves to live in the forest. Most people, they love that. It's beautiful. But we think our general public, I think, is really caught up in the idea that things are going to be this way. We all have a uncle or grandfather that says this is the way things were. And we get that in our mind, they're going to be that way. Well, these are very dynamic systems, like most ecosystems, and they're changing all the time. And so when we build that home at the end of the road might be extended for one thing. But maybe we live up against some federal land and we think, oh, we've got the sweet spot. But then somebody else does that north or south of us, and it goes on and on. And it's sold to us as a stagnant, beautiful, forested environment that's going to be this your escape from the world, and it's going to be beautiful. But one thing about that is it's not going to change. Well, we know that's not real, but we make those assumptions. And one of the big modes of change, and it'll always come, it's a matter of whether it'll come next year or a decade from now or a century from now, is some form of fire in most Western forests. And we don't think, you don't see that on the real estate brochure, let's say. Mm-hmm. But so it's very effective. And then we have this idea of boundless growth and boundless consumerism, which is interweaved in that. Real estate agents are not coaching us on caution. They're telling us more and everything's going to be great. That's their business. We need some societal sober looks at what are the limits? What should we be doing there? We don't want people to be hurt. We don't want homes burning down, but we're also taking away from habitat for wildlife, for other plants and animals and so on. So there's a lot of issues that I just rattled off mm-hmm. there that all kind of come to a head, but our juggernaut of growth is really butting up against the flames that are going to come. So what I try to put across in this chapter is a wise person would understand, first of all, let's limit that growth. Let's stop for a minute, push the pause button. But if we do live in those places, how do we live effectively with this and really expect it to come sooner or later?
Let's take another brief break. When we come back, I want to have you talk about Island Park. This is a place you've studied with regard to fire. Paul Rogers is with us. He is adjunct professor in the Department of Environment and Society, USU Ecology Center Associate and Director for Western Aspen Alliance. And we'll talk some more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with USU Professor Paul Rogers. He has a chapter in the book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. His chapter's on wildfire. We've been talking about that. We'll continue that here. Paul Rogers is adjunct professor in the Department of Environment and Society. You focus on Island Park here. Tell us, Island Park's a little bit different, right? It's not quite as rich, for one thing.
It is, Tom, and I appreciate you bringing that up. And I was thinking as you were recapping my bio here, being a Department of Environment and Society, that it brings these elements to a confluence here. We have a physical environment, but we have sociological, political, economic aspects coming together in this place called Island Park. And you're exactly right. I purposefully chose something that wasn't the iconic resort town of the West, where people have a lot of resources, but where people are, it's a middle class getaway and has been for a long time. It has a history of that. And so there's a smaller full-time residency there. If I recall right, it's a few thousand people that live there full-time. But you have a lot of folks that have summer cabins there and have for decades. They may be coming from some of the surrounding cities, Bozeman, Idaho Falls, Salt Lake City, and so on. And they probably go there for a few weeks every summer and have a getaway. And the key in terms of fire is that it's kind of we show up, we unlock the place, and we hang out for a while. It's very low maintenance. Contrasting with that is this setting is in a giant caldera that's adjacent to a more famous caldera called Yellowstone National Park. It was born in fire. It was born in pyroclastic explosion millions of years ago. And now the vegetation there is predominantly lodgepole pine, a highly flammable forest that grows densely. And so it's a setting not unlike some of those that are mentioned in the book, like you mentioned Paradise, California, where people live in and among trees. And again, there's not a lot of resources. And then stacked on top of that, there's a real Western libertarian kind of sociological or approach to life. And it's the go it alone. It goes right back to what Robert Frodman was talking about, this mythology of the lone soldier. We can do this on our own, and don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me where to cut trees or how to protect my home. I got this covered. But I'm going to tell you, they ain't seen nothing like what overran Paradise until it happens. And that's the thing, is the rare event, that cataclysmic disturbance that we haven't lived with, is really just around the corner, or at least we should anticipate it being so.
I guess the other point that you point out in the book here is that if you have this individualistic point of view, fine, but you may not be able to get the fire suppression done that you need to do, that you probably would want to do. That's a collective thing that would help that happen.
Yeah, and I should say they're making some forays in this direction. Mm-hmm. There's some participation in civic groups or partnerships with the federal government. In this case, it's the U.S. Forest Service. In and among and interwoven with the homes there is Forest Service land, and so trying to come together and develop a strategy for the area is beginning to happen, but there's a lot of resistance to that. And interestingly, one of the main themes that came out in a questionnaire that I cite in this is that folks wanted to blame outside environmental groups for the problem, or they wanted to blame someone else. And again, this comes up again and again, is the idea that it's somebody else did this to us, or the fires did this to us, it was those other people. But it's taking ownership in a literal sense of what's going on here. This is my property. How do I participate, not just on my small patch, but the adjacent homes and in partnership with those around me to address this situation? And there's a lot that needs to be done, and there's almost no budget for it. So is it going to be sweat and labor? Are we going to get outside money? How are we going to do this? But the first thing is to realize the limits, but also then to start developing a plan that will work for our community, not for the Aspen, Colorados, or the Park City, Utahs, or so on, where there's a lot more resources there.
Tell me some of the bullet points of a plan that might work for Island Park, and then maybe what would work generally.
Yeah, and these do apply in a lot of other places. So first of all is to get a handle on the sprawl. And people think it's funny that we talk about concentrated living, but if we talk about long-term sustainable living, whether it's in almost any community, if they're facing all different kinds of issues, wildfire or not, how do we do that and preserve our water and our landscapes and our wildlife? we're going to come to those things. And those can, those don't have to be negative. We have a negative opinion of concentrated living. But continuing to sprawl out has a lot more impacts for fewer people. So that's one issue there, is to address sprawl. Another is a collective action plan in a time of crisis, which they're already working on in Island Park. That's a good thing, is how do we evacuate, those kind of emergency things. But long term, thinking about, you know, there's, I've got all these photos of homes in Island Park with a propane tank next to the home, or with wood stacked under a wooden porch, firewood. With trees growing up through and around the roofing and decking and so on, with tiny rutted access roads that you could not get a firefighting vehicle into. Addressing those practical problems on the ground, it's going to be needed. Otherwise, we might be looking at disaster. Again, back to that questionnaire, a lot of folks in the Island Park area just thought, well, my insurance will cover this, or the forest firefighters will just come and save me. Well, that's fascinating from a libertarian perspective, right? Somebody else is going to do that, and even more interesting, it's going to be the federal government. I'm not sure that's thought through all the way. Like most Western states, Idaho receives about $1.23 for every dollar they pay in taxes. They get a lot of resources for what they pay, but they still want to maintain that individualistic sort of libertarian approach to life, that everything will be cool and I've got this covered. However, when it comes to collective action, you know, again, think of some of the other big disturbances. You can't stop a hurricane with individuals. You can't stop the Mississippi River flooding. You need some sort of collective action. And we have this wonderful phrase in our society: we don't build in a floodplain. I would like people to apply that to the fire realm. Do we build in, you know, why not that same logic? We're not there yet. But those are some of the bullet points that come to mind. And then a broad approach to fire suppression, because you brought that issue up earlier, is basically concentrating fire suppression near development as well as fire prevention near development. But away from it, we need to let more of these fires burn. And that may seem counterintuitive to folks. But if we want resilient communities for a lot of other resources, we need to let those burn and concentrate our efforts near where people are already living, and sort of let's take a pause here and limit as more growth out into fire prone areas.
I wanted to go back to messaging. You say messaging is key to living with fire. Your chapter's at home with forest fires in the West. You talk a little bit about Smokey the Bear, right? Or is it Smokey Bear? I can never...
Smokey the Bear, yeah.
Is it the Bear?
Yeah, I poke a little fun at him. Yeah. You know, go ahead.
So that's one side of it, right? Only you can prevent forest fires. On the other hand, we've gotten to this messaging, you say, of this is outside our control. This is, you know, this force of nature, which obviously it is, but we have no control.
Correct. And that's really interesting, because Smokey provides a good vector for communicating the change that's taken place. I've been harping on this a long time, that's just a completely false statement. Only you can prevent that. However, that has changed with this development, and we should be aware of that. When I started talking about these issues, even 30, 40 years ago, most fire starts were from natural causes, lightning, touching off the ground, could be a stump smoldering sometimes for days or weeks, and then eventually the right weather conditions come up and that turns into a conflagration. But now, with more homes, more development, more recreation out in these areas, we've flipped over to where now more of the fires in the West are started by humans. We hope accidentally, although there's some we hear about nefarious fire starters. However, that is switched, and that's switched with the evolution. But I kind of gently push back at Smokey and saying this may not be the right representative of this whole program as we begin to live with fire. And the idea of understanding that I live in a fire-prone landscape, first of all, maybe I should pause and not build a new home there. But if I already live there, how can I do that effectively? And I suggest this broad strategy of concentrating our efforts something called FireWise Landscapes. USU has some extension material on that, where we trim back things from our home. We look at our home as a fire-prone landscape, and we try to trim that back. The idea of clean and green they talk about, so more you know, from a vegetation ecologist position, is more water in the plant makes it more fire resistant. The drier it is, less so. It seems intuitive. But getting those things back from the dwellings, for example, maybe switching out of a propane mechanism for heating or cooking or so on, or getting it further away from the home, some of those things, and then tapering that off as you get farther out, 100 feet, 200 feet, 300 feet, et cetera. And then maybe for most of those homes in Island Park, especially where there's not a lot of resources, you're off of your own property by the time you get to 100 or 200 feet and you're into the adjacent lands. And that's where the partnerships come in, either neighbors or other federal agencies. We're going to have to work together and coordinate our efforts if we're going to be effective. And then one more thing back to my bailiwick here is potentially encouraging aspen. Aspen is more fire resistant than these other trees. So maybe encouraging that where that's possible near the home as a fire, not preventer, but maybe a fire slower. I tell folks that any vegetation will burn in the right conditions. However, if we're thinking probabilistically, this may be a helpful thing to have more aspen in and around homes in a community to slow things down if the fire comes over the ridge as we're taking other preventative methods as we go forward.
Maybe we can end there. What's the latest with aspen? You're always working on issues regarding aspen.
I am. And worldwide, we're talking about biodiversity and this great landscapes where we can prevent biodiversity. Where we can promote biodiversity. And aspen tend to grow in conifer environments, and they tend to be full of rich communities of plants and animals. And so I'm working on that across Asia and with international partners, as well as continuing to do so in the American West. And then in regards to this book, you know, in the end, we need to understand limits, but put them in the framework of our own ethics system. Would we want these sustainable communities to go forth in the future for our offspring? And I think ethically, most of us would agree that we should leave the place as good or better than we found it.
By the way, what are you working on now? What's your research now?
Yeah, my research now, I've got a total assessment of aspen in Bryce Canyon National Park. That's something that's in the mix, working on that, as well as a little bit more overseas work, maybe pushing toward Eastern Europe again this spring, and hopefully return to Mongolia, where we did some things there with forests at large and forest ecology, as well as aspen.
All right. Very good. Well, we'll end it here. Paul Rogers has been our guest. He has a chapter in the new book, A Watershed Moment, and he's an adjunct professor in the Department of Environment and Society. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. A pleasure spending this hour with you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Skywatcher Leo T here. Look up, look around, get a little lost in space. After dark, we don't need a spaceship to look to the south-southeast for Orange Antares, a red supergiant of summer. This is the beautiful center of the Scorpion, which is one of the few constellations that I actually think looks like its namesake. Around and upper right of Antares, the other wider stars of Upper Scorpius form their distinctive pattern. The row of three stars upper right of Antares traditionally marks the Scorpion's head. In binoculars or a small telescope, the top one, Beta Scorpii, is a magical double star that looks like a big and smaller atom hanging out in space, and when aligned with another star, make a cosmic triangle. The tail of the Scorpion extends down toward the horizon, with the tail ending with two beautiful cat's eyes barely sticking above the horizon. Scorpius is a magical treat of summer, always low and twinkly on the horizon, with many swirly, faint star patterns and sparkly colors amidst the bigger stars. Stay tuned for Skywatcher Leo T's Star Party coming soon. We'll get together and look at them ourselves. And on Sunday, June 20th, the summer solstice, also known as festival solstice or midsummer, occurs when one of the Earth's poles has its maximum tilt toward the sun. It happens twice yearly, once in each hemisphere. For that hemisphere, the summer solstice is when the sun reaches its highest position in the sky and is the day with the longest period of daylight. Within the Arctic Circle, Antarctic Circle, there is continuous daylight around the summer solstice, this marking the first day of summer in the northern hemisphere and the first day of winter in the southern hemisphere. Also on June 20th, the same day as the solstice, NASA astronaut Shane Kimbrew and European Space Agency astronaut Thomas Pesquet will make their second six-hour spacewalk together this month to install another new solar array outside the International Space Station. Happy walking. If you're an early riser, you can watch the spacewalk live on NASA TV at 6 a.m. Also, if you're up, you can catch Jupiter and Saturn up there in the sky. On Skywatcher Leo T, it's one sky, many cultures. Today, we'll travel to northern Montana and visit the Blackfoot tribe. The Blackfoot believe the above people, or sky beings, were the first creations. The first sky being is Natosi, the sun, who is highly venerated by the Blackfoot people and ruler of the sky people. Other sky beings include the moon goddess. Natosi, the sun god, is married to the moon goddess, and their son is the morning star hero. To the Blackfoot, the stars in the sky, or sky beings, are sacred spirits and live in the sky world far above the clouds with their own society and land. So if you're out on a dark night and there is a slight breeze and the big puffy clouds hanging low and heat lightning pulsing on the horizon and lightning talking between the clouds and a few stars in the sky, feel the energy of the sky beings around you. As we look up, look around, and get a little lost in space.